from both sides. White people didn't like her because they thought Mammy was too sassy. Black people didn't like her because they thought she was too demeaning. And the NAACP waged an all-out war against her. So that really shocked me as well.
Rashonda Tate, screenwriter, movie producer, award-winning and best-selling author. Her latest book is entitled The Queen of Sugar Hill, a novel of Hattie McDaniel, published by HarperCollins Publishers. One would have thought after becoming the first African-American to win an Oscar for a role in the iconic film Gone with the Wind, Hattie McDaniel's career had reached the pinnacle for which she had worked so hard. But months after winning the award, not only did the Oscar curse set in where she couldn't find work, but she found herself thrust in the middle of two worlds, black and white, and not being welcome in either one. Whites only saw her as Mammy, and black detested the demeaning portrayal. As the NAACP waged an all-out war against her, she continued to fight to pave a path for other black actors, fighting housing discrimination and navigating four failed marriages. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Queen of Sugar Hill, a novel of Hattie McDaniel with Rashonda Tate, In Black America.
You know, it's really just about her place in history. In her Academy Awards speech, she says that she wanted to always be a credit to her race. And I think for so long that was lost. And what I'm hoping this book does is help reshine that light on her, as well as introduce her to a whole generation of people who just may not even know about her or may not know the extent of her contributions to our world. I have a 16-year-old son who had never heard of her. And even when I began this process, kept calling her Hattie LaBelle. But when I finally got him to understand, he was just like, wow, why don't I know anything about her? And I said, well, that's what we're hoping to change.
In her latest work, The Queen of Sugar Hill, author Rashonda Tate presents a fictional portrait of Hattie McDaniel, one of Hollywood's most prolific but woefully unappreciated stars, and the first African-American ever to win an Oscar in 1940 for a role as Mammy in the film classic Gone with the Wind. The award was supposed to be a game-changer, a life-changing moment. It was, but not what McDaniel envisioned. Little did she know, that triumph would be followed by a series of challenges that would test her resilience and determination. Despite winning the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress, that historic win didn't create greater opportunities for her career. She went on to portray more amazing films, accepting at least 74 maid roles, with Mammy being her most famous performance. Earning credit for all her hard work was also a problem. Although the actor appeared in more than 300 films, she received film credit for only 83. Recently in Black America, spoke with author Rashonda Tate.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm going to begin with the questions that I asked you before we went on air. How has the tour been thus far on the book tour?
It's wonderful. I am just amazed at all the people that are coming out. Great crowds, great talking to people, and just enlightening and educating people. So it's wonderful.
What made you want to write about Hattie McDaniel?
My grandmother loved Gone with the Wind. I did not. I didn't like Hattie McDaniel because I felt she was portraying this demeaning stereotype. And my grandmother said, so you don't like her playing a maid, but I am a maid. So why are you looking at her with disdain? And by the way, it's 1939. What did you expect her to play, Scarlett O'Hara? And at that point, I started looking at Hattie McDaniel through a different lens. And I think that's part of the problem with so many people that have some kind of way about her, is we look at her through a 21st century lens. And once I took that off, I was able to see her for the legend that she is.
During that process, how long did it take you to put this particular work together?
It took me almost 3 years because I really did a lot of research. I had to get off the internet because I discovered that a lot of the information on the internet was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to research libraries. I also did census records, read a whole lot of newspapers from back in the day. And so I did a lot of research, so much in fact that my girlfriend said, okay, you need to stop researching and go write the book.
Once you started writing the book, what were some of the things that really surprised you about Hattie McDaniel?
it really surprised me that she was a quiet warrior. You know, we're so used to our activists being loud and proud and power to the people, but Hattie was a quiet warrior. She brought about change because she had a seat at the table. For example, there are things that didn't make it into the movie, derogatory things that didn't make it into the Gone with the Wind movie, because Hattie McDaniel had them change. And she was able to do that because she had a seat at the table. And she was often criticized because people felt she wasn't doing enough for Blacks. But so I was really surprised to see that, you know, the changes she was making. I also was stunned at the hate that she got from both sides. White people didn't like her because they thought Mammy was too sassy. Black people didn't like her because they thought she was too demeaning. And the NAACP waged an all-out war against her. So that really shocked me as well.
In reading the book, I was particularly pleasantly surprised. If it wasn't for her brother Otis, we would not have known about Hattie McDaniel.
Right. I mean, Hattie's mother, a former slave, right, had her ready to go be a domestic, just like she was. But Otis had that entertainment bug, and he had his sister out performing when she was just 6 years old, and she always had that entertainment drive in her.
Why was it important for you to begin your narrative at the Academy Awards?
You know, I didn't want to do a cradle-to-grave story. I really wanted to do the moment that most people knew her for, and then take you on a journey on all the things you didn't know.
Now, when you started the narrative, talk to us about Hattie McDaniel living in Denver, because I didn't know she grew up in Denver, and that's where her career started.
Right. A lot of people didn't know that Hattie McDaniel was the first Black woman to ever have music on the radio. And so she had a thriving career in Denver. That's where the springboard happened. Everyone thinks she started in movies in Los Angeles, but she had built a long career before that.
Now, once she left Denver, talk to us about her moving to Los Angeles.
So her brother Sam and sister Etta were already there, and Sam was working on a show called The Optimistic Do-Nuts with Bing Crosby and some others. And so they told her, come on, we'll get you in entertainment. And she moved there, and she actually was in 70 unaccredited movies before Gone with the Wind. So everyone thinks that's what put her on the stage, but she had been toiling for about 8 years just trying to get into the industry.
Talk to us about her being a songwriter and a performer in the minstrel shows.
Right. So that's where she got her and her sister. That's where they got their start. They had the McDaniel sisters. They had a little a vaudeville show that they would do singing, dancing and skits. And Otis was their manager. He was the one always going around and putting the family to work. And it's just been in their blood. Their mother was a singer, but her dreams were squashed because you couldn't make money as a singer. And she became a domestic, and that's what she thought her children were destined to be. And they were like, nope, Mom, we're going to entertain.
Now, talk to us about some of her, I guess, her ride and die partners as she was navigating after the Academy Awards. Things didn't go the way that she thought they should have gone. But I think she had, I saw something on Oprah and Gail. So she had a Gail Garros with her to help her navigate those waters.
Yeah, she was good friends with Louise Beavers and Lillian Randolph from Imitation of Life and It's a Wonderful Life. And really, those were her just ride-or-die girlfriends at the time, because she needed that. All three of them were similar actresses, and they had similar hate. And so they bonded over that, along with Ruby Dandridge, who was Dorothy Dandridge's mother. And it was that core group of friends that helped her navigate the fact that her career didn't take off after the Oscars, which she had hoped for. Then she was also good friends with Clark Gable, Betty Davis. So she had a solid foundation of friends that helped her through the good and the bad times in Los Angeles.
Talk to us about her friendship with Clark Gable, because in your writings, he stood up for her, even though she didn't want to stand up for herself sometimes.
He did. And in fact, she had to rein him in sometimes. For example, the Atlanta premiere, they did a big event, And Hattie wasn't invited. So Clark Gable was like, well, I'm not going. And she had to say, you're the star. You're king of Hollywood. You can't do this. You have to go. But he was a very good friend to Hattie McDaniel and vice versa. And so he really would fight in some instances where she couldn't.
Now, it sounded interesting once she won the Academy Award and then Selznick wanted to go out on the road. But that really didn't work out too well because you were talking about whites didn't really want to see her and African Americans, particularly the NAACP, was ostracizing her.
Right, and she was being met at protests. So they took the Mammy Show on the road and it just started losing money. And she wanted to do something different, but that's what people expected from her. So she even got to the point where she would try and incorporate, would put Mammy on, she would try and incorporate different things in her performance. And they eventually had to just cancel the shows because people didn't want to see it on the road.
You also write about her being uplifted with Eleanor Roosevelt giving her an award.
Yes, so at the New York Fair, this New York State
mm-hmm,
Fair,
right.
She was honored by Eleanor Roosevelt, who at the time when she auditioned, Eleanor wanted her maid to play the role.
Right.
So that tells you how much people came to respect Hattie McDaniel, and Eleanor honored her at that time.
Since you mentioned it, how did Hattie McDaniel get the role?
So Hattie was an actual maid, went from her job in her maid's uniform to audition. She was the last one to audition. This was the most coveted role in Hollywood. Everybody wanted this role. And they had two roles left to fill, Scarlett O'Hara and Mammy. And Hattie interviewed or auditioned with Vivian Leigh, and the chemistry was there. And so she commanded that role and made it her own, and they offered it to her immediately.
The book is pretty thick. How much did you have to leave out?
Oh, quite a bit. You know, one of the biggest things is Hattie McDaniel's love life. She was married four times, but Hattie was a woman. She loved some men and some other things. And I had to rein some of that in. Number one, it's kind of how you find out your grandmother thinks about your grandmother you would
mm-hmm.
rather not know. I dealt with that. But then I had to kind of condense that. And then she did much more with the war effort. I had to kind of leave some of that out because the book was already thick.
How did you come up with the idea of the way you wrote the book? Obviously, there's a historical perspective, but also there's some left to your imagination. How did you mirror the two?
Yeah, so this was the best of both worlds for me because I'm a journalist by trade. And then this allowed me to use that journalism background to research, to lay the foundation. And then the novelist side of me was able to come in and fill in the blanks. So the foundation of The Queen of Sugar Hill is all facts. The fill in the blank comes in. That's the fiction part. For example, we know Hattie McDaniel and the entire Gone with the Wind crew went to a club after the Academy Awards. The club did not allow Hattie McDaniel in. That's the fact that we know. The fiction comes in is we don't know exactly what the security guard said to her. So that's where my imagination comes in. And that's the fiction part. But everything else is the facts. And I try to be clear in sticking to the facts.
As being one of only African-American actresses back in the day, what are some of the things that she helped other African-Americans achieve during that period?
So she really did. By having a seat at the table, she opened up doors for people to come in behind her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been lost along the way. As my grandmother said, we look at her being a domestic, we look at it with disdain. Well, number one, at the time, that's all people were offered. And so she opened the door to show that we are more than actual servants and slaves. We are actors. Now, she got a lot of a pushback because she was a comedian and she was silly. And her feedback was, Lucille Ball can play silly comedic roles and it's fine. But when I do it, it's an indictment of my entire race. And that's something we still see wrestling with, especially in the Black community today.
You talk about her love life and her four failed marriages. Talk to us about the first one, I think, and he just dogged her out, basically, and then reappeared in her life. Talk to us about those relationships.
So that was her second husband. Her very first husband, she married when she was young. They loved each other, but she wanted a career and he wanted a wife to be at home. But the second husband actually already was married when he married Hattie McDaniel. And so he just disappeared one day, and that's fact. And so the fiction comes in. I don't know exactly what she said to him when he showed back up, but I can imagine. So that's where my imagination comes in. And then she was married two more times, both to men who just kind of used her for her money, especially her last husband. And so, you know, that was part of me, a part of the story that kind of was sad, because she really did want to be loved, and she just had the hardest time finding that love.
You're listening to In Black America with John L. Hanson, Jr. We'll be back with more of our conversation in just a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Shonda Tate, screenwriter, movie producer, best-selling author, and her latest work, The Queen of Sugar Hill, a novel of Hattie McDaniel. Miss Tate, one would not know that Sugar Hill is a neighborhood in Los Angeles.
It is, and it is named paid in homage to the Sugar Hill in New York. That's the one everybody immediately thinks of.
Right.
Sugar Hill used to be called the West Adams District. And when Hattie McDaniel moved in, she was one of the first blacks in the area. They had a few more who had moved in before her. And she was excited about her place. She bought this as a mansion. It's her dream home. She paid $10,000 above asking costs. And a lot of people don't know there was a little known law at the time called restrictive covenants, which meant you could not sell your home to anyone who was not of European descent. And so Hattie's neighbors sued her and her other black neighbors to try and get her out of there.
Now, during that process, she didn't even know that particular court case was going to take place until someone pulled her coattail.
Right. So they had been trying to sue some of the other neighbors, and Hattie had not been involved in that because she had been so busy.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't getting any traction. And then when she came on board, she became the face of the lawsuit, and they actually went to court and they won the case, which was something no one thought would happen. And that case became the catalyst for the Supreme Court case that struck down restrictive covenants. So people don't even realize we live where we want now because of Hattie McDaniel.
I know that's right. We're speaking weeks away from the Academy Awards. Why is this particular story important that America should know about Hattie McDaniel?
You know, it's really just about her place in history. In her Academy Awards speech, she says that she wanted to always be a credit to her race. And I think for so long that was lost. And what I'm hoping this book does is help reshine that light on her, as well as introduce her to a whole generation of people who just may not even know about her or may not know the extent of her contributions to our world. I have a 16-year-old son who had never heard of her. And
mm-hmm.
even when I began this process, kept calling her Hattie LaBelle. But when I finally got him to understand, he was just like, wow, why don't I know anything about her? And I said, well, that's what we're hoping to change.
When you started this project, did you feel that it was going to resonate the way it has thus far?
You know, I always believed in it. In fact, so I went to her mansion in Sugar Hill, and I stood outside, and I just felt her talking to me. And I told my sister one time when I finished, I said, Hattie is pleased. My sister said, well, I thought she was dead. I said, she is, but she's still pleased. Because I felt like that people were going to finally say, wow, how did we not know all of this? And that's the reaction I'm getting as I tour the country with the book.
Do we know where her Academy Award is?
She bequeathed it to Howard University. Howard has never confirmed this, but the rumors are that when they began the riots in the early 70s, they threw it in the Potomac River because they did not like her character. But last year, October of 2023, the Academy Awards finally replaced her Oscar. So her replacement Oscar is sitting in the halls of Howard University.
Has the NAACP ever apologized from the way they treated her back in the day?
They have not, and I think a lot of the current people aren't even aware of it. And here's the thing with it, is Walter White, who was the executive director of the NAACP, he really did think he was doing a good thing. I think they were well-meaning in their efforts. They just wanted better representation on screen. But they did it at the expense of Hattie and actresses like her, actors in general like her. And I don't think that they realized the detriment they were doing. And it was something that Hattie struggled with her whole life.
When you look back of the work thus far, what has been your fondest memories of this project?
Really just the new discovery, the discovery of everything. And then now the part of is just going from city to city, talking about her and seeing people riveted as we discuss Hattie McDaniel and her life. And so I absolutely love that. But the journey was just all the new discoveries that I was making.
While you're on tour, how do you begin your conversation with the audience?
So I generally talk about Hattie's story. And I do just kind of like the book. I began overall with the Academy Award. And then I go back to give a little bit of her history, how we got here. And then I kind of go through, and I do keep it short, entertaining, concise, but I really want to introduce people to an overview of her life and then hope they'll go and read the book and kind of get more insight into it.
With Hattie McDaniels being such an accomplished entertainer, were there others of her generation that just didn't have an opportunity to showcase their talent?
Oh, absolutely. There were so many talented actresses. And Hattie's dear friend, Lillian, who was Mammy Two Shoes, which was in the Tom and Jerry cartoon, she was the voice of Mammy Two Shoes, which was huge at that time. And she really was one of those who also always wrestled with the hate that she got. And it affected her in that she just began withdrawing. And so there were so many talented actors of that time who just kind of withdrew and kept to themselves because they didn't like the hate they were getting from the Black community. And their argument was always, what else would you have us to do?
Being ostracized so frequently by the African-American community, did it have a detrimental effect on Hattie's health?
Absolutely. I believe that that's part of what led to her not realizing that she had breast cancer until it was too far gone. And even her doctors, her records, that the stress of her life took its toll on her. She never had children. She desperately wanted children. And one of the doctors actually blamed it on all of the stress that she had in pursuing her career. And that became a source of contention between her and her then husband.
Are there any new projects on the horizon?
They are. So I am in love now with historical fiction and discovering these unsung heroes. So my next book I'm already working on is on Hazel Scott. And Hazel is the former wife of Adam Clayton Powell Jr., but she was one of the biggest jazz singers of our time, Black or white. And people that don't know about her because she was vocal in her support of civil rights, so they deemed her a communist, and she's all but been erased from history. So her story is fascinating as well, and that's what I'm working on.
When you went to the publishers about doing this particular book, what was their reaction?
I actually, for the first time in all these books that I had a bidding war. So in my agent sent it out, and within 3 days, we had multiple publishers who wanted it. So I'm very excited and blessed. And it tells you the need for her story. So, I'm just loving what I'm doing with it and sharing it. But I, from the very beginning, I had the interest.
What do you want readers to come away with once they've read your work?
That Hattie McDaniel's story deserves to live on. I would hate for her to just kind of disappear from history, which she has slowly been doing. When Monique won Academy Award, she mentioned her. But that's all that people knew her for was that one Academy Award. And there's so much more to her. And as she said, she hopes that people will remember that she was more than Mammy.
Obviously, you don't work in a vacuum. Who are some of the people that uplift you during this process?
Oh, I constantly have supporters. I have a writing squad. They're writers as well. So they're authors, and we share ideas. And then I have a great support system at home for my sister and my husband. And I think all of those are necessary to make a total package. And I'm blessed to have all of that.
I guess the $100,000 question now, have you seen Gone with the Wind since you've written the book?
I have, and I've looked at it. I took off my 21st century glasses. Now, it will never be one of my most favorite movies, like my grandmother, but I have a different appreciation for it, and I was able to enjoy it. It is a well-written story, and so taking off the lens, I was able to enjoy it.
Speaking of that 21st century lens, what would you tell readers of your book and those who hopefully will watch the film to look for, to understand?
To understand that, number one, she was a comedic actor at the time. So people will always say, well, did she have to be bug-eyed and loud? Well, she was being a comedic actor in that quote-unquote serious situation. And then to always look at, which I never did when I was seeing her, is that Hattie had a position of power in that movie. Hattie ran that plantation. And in us looking at back in the past, we always focus on the negative. And instead of seeing that if it wasn't for her, things would have fallen apart on this plantation. And so I choose to focus on the positives of the story instead of the negatives of that time frame.
Any final comments, Rashonda?
Just that I hope that people will continue learning about Hattie, reading the book, sharing the book. My hope is that it will just continue what we call have legs as people learn about it.
Rashonda Tate, author of The Queen of Sugar Hill, a novel of Hattie McDaniel. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You're going to hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessary, though, of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
You are listening to In Black America here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Around the turn of the 20th century, traditional life insurance companies were underwriting actively against the lives of people of color, to the point where there was, you know, published research that valued the life of a person of color at around one-third that of majority culture people, which means that premiums were three times as high, at least, for people of color. So that was one way of denying, you know, opportunity to build financial asset portfolio to people of color. So the reaction to that was, a natural and corollary reaction to that was, faith-based institutions and captains of industry and communities of color all around the country, in places like New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles and Atlanta and Detroit and Chicago, Tulsa, they all had a similar model to the development of what became 32 black-owned insurance companies that existed into the mid-20th century.
Brian Sims, founder and president of Mammoth Life and Reinsurance Company. Mammoth Life is the nation's only minority-owned distribution reinsurance carrier focused on delivering data-advanced digital life products to underserved communities. In 1964, the federal government banned discriminatory race-based insurance premiums, while federal law explicitly prevents insurers from applying discriminatory premium based on race. The insurance application and underwriting process still contain discriminatory practices that can result in higher premiums for African Americans. Zip code has been one of the most prevalent disqualifiers. When people who lived in historically African American neighborhoods apply for life insurance, they can be seen as higher risk. The reason? People living in these zip codes may statistically face higher instances of health risks like diabetes or high blood pressure. I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Brian Sims, founder and president of Mammoth Life and Reinsurance Company, In Black America.
We knew how to build product that was engineered to fit the marketplace affordably. So we just decided to resurrect one of the Black-owned insurance companies that had gone defunct. We're an inspired brand. We're not the same company, but we're an inspired brand that was inspired by the Louisville, Kentucky version of that Black-owned insurance company that was called Mammoth Life and Accident, founded in 1915 by former slaves in partnership with churches and business leaders of the time to ensure the lives of people of color who had no access to financial services prop. Mammoth Life and Reinsurance is inspired by the success of that brand.
For most African Americans, their first exposure to the benefits of life insurance occurs when a family member passes away. Minorities in this country are disproportionately underinsured compared to white Americans, which often results in death benefits that fail to cover end-of-life expenses or outstanding debts. When family members of the deceased receive insufficient benefits payout, it makes it more difficult to trust insurance companies and life insurance products. Mammoth Life and Reinsurance is in the business to change that perception. Launched in Kentucky in 2021, Mammoth Life and Reinsurance Company is the only minority business enterprise certified life and reinsurance company in the nation. Its mission is to help empower and educate African Americans about the importance and value of investing in life insurance. Recently in Black America spoke with Brian Sims.
I am a native Virginian who went to a little small private school in Norfolk, Virginia that's older than this country. Migrated from there to Duke University in the early 80s. That choice was not one that I made willingly, but I'm grateful for it. My parents were both educators and products of a time, you know, segregated school system at a time when there were two options for people of color, and that was teach or preach. So they both graduated from the neighboring college, which was at that time North Carolina Teachers College. Now it is North Carolina Central University. They could not have attended Duke at that time. Duke was not admitting people of color. So when my admission came in the door, it was a foregone conclusion that I was going to get my undergraduate degree from there. I finished there, went to work for a few years for an insurance company called Great American out of Cincinnati, Ohio, which was at the time one of the largest family-owned insurance companies in the country. And from there to the University of Virginia, where I studied and they gave me my MBA, my Master's of Business Administration, in the mid-90s. From the mid-90s until about 10 years ago, I spent all of that time in Manhattan working at J.P. Morgan, Lazard, Morgan Stanley, so you know, pretty white shoe investment banks, and learning the trade of how money is made and how money is managed, how money is preserved, and how money is passed along in generations. So about 10 years ago, I started working with a bunch of UVA alumni, University of Virginia alumni, who were advanced in their careers and financially successful and wanted to give back to the university in a very specific way. And that very specific way was to invest in the startup businesses for University of Virginia alumni. These kinds of this group was called Cav Angels. It is not a unique group, but most of the kind of super Ivy League and Ivy League colleges all have similar organizations that are not part of the university, but private, but benefit the students and they benefit the alumni of the colleges. So we took advantage of a lot of opportunity to commercialize intellectual property that resided at the university. And I learned an awful lot about the art of investing in startups. One of the startups that I was on the board of was a Cav Angels investment, and that started me into the insurance technology business. So interestingly enough about this particular business is that it was founded by 2/3 of the founders were of color. And where you see right now a lot of opportunity to buy what's called instant issue insurance policies from companies like Ethos, who advertise that, you know, fill out a short application and then we can have $1 million of insurance coverage to you in 15 minutes in your email box. The platform that was the progenitor to that business was created by people of color. And that was 10 years ago. So it was a first mover business. We learned an awful lot about dealing with carriers and building insurance product and reinsuring insurance product and the distribution side of the business and how that should work more actively. So fast forward to about 2 years ago, one of the founders and I decided to exit that business, the old business, and because we had been exposed to the tragic story of the Black-owned insurance company, which is, do you want me to go down this path?
Yes, go ahead.
So this story, and I'll make it brief for you, it is a really tragic one. So around the turn of the 20th century, traditional insurance, life insurance companies were underwriting actively against the lives of people of color, to the point where there was, you know, published research that valued the life of a person of color at around 1/3 that of majority culture people, which means that premiums were 3 times as high, at least, for people of color. So that was one way of denying, you know, opportunity to build financial asset portfolio to people of color. So the reaction to that was, a natural and corollary reaction to that was, faith-based institutions and captains of industry and communities of color all around the country in places like New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles and Atlanta and Detroit and Chicago, Tulsa, they all had a similar model to the development of what became 32 Black-owned insurance companies that existed into the mid-20th century. And that common ancestry was all founded by former slaves. Every one of those companies was founded by a former slave. They were formed as a partnership between faith-based institutions, churches, and communities, and captains of industry who were looking to pool assets in order to ensure basic specie needs for communities of color, for people in communities of color who didn't have access to financial services products. So think burial insurance. They called it industrial insurance at the time, and the history of it is called the 15-cent policy, where agents would go from door to door collecting 15 cents a week from constituents in order to ensure the loss of a weekly paycheck, for whom a lot of people, that was a disastrous event. Fast forward into the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s of the 20th century, every single one of those insurance companies went defunct, went belly up for a number of reasons, whether it be, you know, malfeasance, lack of capital being the largest reason for the demise of the Black-owned insurance company, competition, et cetera. Today, there are only 2 Black-owned insurance companies in this country, only 2. We are the only Black-founded insurance company in the country. The other Black-owned insurance company is owned by Magic Johnson, called Equitrust in Los Angeles. Both of us are similarly trying to solve for the same problem, which is it's a pretty unique one. A lot of traditional insurers understand, and the industry research will point to 106 million Americans that are underinsured or not insured at all. And every single one of these traditional carriers are trying their hardest to access these markets. The problem being that they don't have connection to natural centers of influence, so that they can't cross, you know, into the upper right quadrant of trust and smart that allow people to feel comfortable buying from them. As an example, one of the large carriers, one of the top three carriers in the country, life insurance carriers in the country, has about 80 agents in Atlanta. They only have 8 agents of color out of that 80 agent pool. And this is a city of 450,000 people that is roughly 60% of color, if you're defining it simply along, you know, African-American and majority culture lines. So this story is a typical story of a mismatch between the resources and attention of ability of a traditional carrier to access markets that have a need and actually a greater proclivity to buy life insurance than traditional buyers, meaning the communities of color. But they just haven't figured out how to cross the trust and smart barrier that allow them to sell product that, or even create product that fits that market more effectively. So my partner and I had the luxury of not having legacy traditional carrier infrastructure, meaning compliance structure, regulatory structure, technology to deal with, legacy underwriting practices that we had to defeat because they were 100 years old. We had none of that. And we had the luxury of 10 years of experience using very sophisticated data science tools to better understand mortality and morbidity risk. So at one time, we were smarter than the average bear about how to underwrite and understand what risks existed in the market that were profitable to insure and which were not. In addition, we had the ability to locate those individuals who fit those criteria of, you know, in need to buy insurance. The third piece of what we had was the ability to create product to fit the market, affordable product to fit the market that would give people of color or the uninsured, because it's a socioeconomic exercise for us, much more so than it is an ethnic exercise. If we approach it from a socioeconomic standpoint, we by default will capture people, communities of color. So we knew how to build product that was engineered to fit the marketplace affordably. So we just decided to resurrect one of the Black-owned insurance companies that had gone defunct. We're an inspired brand. We're not the same company, but we're an inspired brand that was inspired by the Louisville, Kentucky version of that Black-owned insurance company that was called Mammoth Life and Accident. So founded in 1915 by former slaves in partnership with churches and business leaders of the time to ensure the lives of people of color who had no access to financial services products. Mammoth Life and Reinsurance is inspired by the success of that brand.
Now, Brian, when we talk about life insurance, there are different types of insurance. What's the difference between term life and whole life insurance?
So term life is not an asset, meaning that you're paying for, it's almost like leasing a car. Okay. As long as you pay the premiums on time, you will have coverage. There's no residual value. There's no market value or cash value associated with that term policy. They tend to be more affordable. They're, by definition, more affordable policies for people, and that's where most people get their starts with term life insurance. Whole life insurance is a completely different animal that can get very sophisticated with, and the simplest way I can put it is that it has a cash value to it. It actually can function at a bare minimum as a savings account for you with some rate of return that's associated with you sharing in the investment success of the issuing company. But that is there, you know, and that runs all the way up through policies that have market facing components to them. That means that you'll be invested in some index, and that's how you get the return that enhances the cash value of that particular policy. So think of whole life policies as more investments. Term life policies are tend to be more stopgap features for people to get them started addressing the needs that they may have on their balance sheet to protect assets.
Yeah, I understand. Let's take a break here. You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson Jr. We'll be back in just a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And speaking with Brian Sims, founder and president of Mammoth Life and Reinsurance, and also managing partner of Purple Pill Ventures. Mr. Sims, when we talk about life insurance, either whole or term, how do we determine how much we need?
There is actual math around that, and it can vary from satisfying basic needs on your balance sheet for cash to be available to take care of future expenses, like think final expense insurance, which is a very specific whole life policy that is a very low face amount, so $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, that's designed to pay just funeral expenses at the time of the insured's death. So there are policies that are designed to satisfy those kinds of needs, which are very kind of, we'll think about them as near-term needs. Mm-hmm. And then there are policies that are that satisfy the higher order desires, if you will, for an insured to have to leave a pool of money, a pot of money that is tax advantaged, to the next generation. So the conversation around how much do you need can vary from what assets do you have on your balance sheet that you'd like to insulate, that you'd like to protect. So think about your mortgage. If you have, $200,000 of mortgage debt on your balance sheet, you can buy a life insurance policy that pays that entire $200,000 off. And it's matched to the liability. So the asset of insurance is matched to the liability of your mortgage, so that when you die, there is no mortgage anymore. It gets paid off. So those are things. It's an asset matching and asset insulation exercise. There's math that can define. And then the rest of it is, how much do you want to leave to your family in a pool of generationally tax-advantaged wealth? And that varies from individual to individual, family to family, et cetera. So think about life insurance as a tool to do three things. One is to insulate yourself against future expenses. Second, it can be an income replacement vehicle. So if I pass early, I'm going to have an amount of insurance that replaces my future income for my current family. And then third, it's a way to create generational wealth in a tax-advantaged way by leaving potentially millions of dollars to the next generation.
Now, what you just articulated is plain and simple. So my next question is, are insurance agents explaining what you just articulated to a point where an individual can make an informed choice?
The data that shows that there are more people applying for and buying life insurance now than ever would point to yes as an answer there. We're great believers in the agency model, and life insurance agents can be a tremendous ally in figuring out what can be very complex, walking you through what are very complex decisions around how much money do you want to leave to your children? How much money do you need to cover your expenses, your current expenses? I mean, current liabilities. How much money do you need currently? How much do you want to invest? And what's the return on that you need in order to satisfy investment return desires? So life insurance agents are uniquely qualified to go through that that process with individuals. Again, the problem with especially people of color getting access to these financial services tools, which, by the way, for wealthy majority culture people, is a staple, absolute staple of their investment portfolio, is the fact that there are no centers of influence or very few centers of influence that can be trusted in order to provide the right advice and the right product to the right people at the right time.
Now, when we look at the life insurance industry, how is your model different or similar to what's currently out there?
Our model is one that is mission related. So that makes us different from Jump Street.
Okay.
Meaning that, and here, I'm going to get a little obtuse with you and share with you some of our thinking in developing an insurance company, insurance business. So if I'm looking at the two needs that developing an insurance company can satisfy. One of them is that we're providing a service and a product to people that allows us to level the wealth inequality playing field measurably. So we can look at the amount of death benefit that we put into the market, and that number compresses that wealth inequality gap. We can measure that. So that's one thing, is that, you know, we're mission related, meaning that we have a mission to serve the underserved. So we're not looking for family offices or the wealthy in this country who have many, many options for buying life insurance. We're looking for folks who are, you know, middle to lower middle income folks who just haven't had exposure to financial services product that can make their lives a little bit easier, or at least their kids' lives a little bit easier. So that's one difference that we have. The second difference that we have is how we're positioned as an organization. So the biggest decision that an insurance company can make is what to do with its general account, with its reserves, with the profits that it makes from writing and underwriting life insurance. A lot of traditional carriers take a very conservative approach to investing that looks like, you know, hiring an investment bank to manage the money. They put it into fixed income to get a fixed rate of return, or they buy equities and expose themselves to stock market returns. And they take some modicum of illiquidity risk by buying, you know, portions of private companies through private equity firms. So that by and large is what larger traditional carriers do. We have a different way of looking at things that harkens back to the reason that Black-owned insurance company was created in the first place, as a means to serve the community. The general account of Mammoth will be invested, you know, in small part in more traditional investments, but we're positioned now to make direct investments into the entrepreneurship ecosystems of any city that we do business in. We're headquartered in Louisville and Atlanta right now. And what I can share with you is that we're very focused on finding and identifying entrepreneurs of color who have brilliant ideas and scalable businesses that we can invest in, and those businesses that can generate cash employment opportunities within the communities that we sell life insurance. So that makes us a little bit different as well. I'll stop right there.
Now, your organization has two divisions. It's the insurance sale and distribution division, but there's also the reinsurance division. What are those entities?
Our focus is on distribution, is on product creation for communities of color, for the underserved. And the reinsurance business is simply a matter for, it's a way for us to participate in the profits of the products that we sell and that we recreate. So the reinsurance business, it's the simplest way to think about that is that as a reinsurer, we are a insurance company for insurance companies. So without getting too complicated about it, traditional carriers write so much life insurance business, the regulatory agencies require that they have a certain amount of money in the bank, mm-hmm. reserves, right. to support them paying claims. When most traditional carriers reach the limit of those reserves, or what those reserves can support in terms of writing new business, then they hire reinsurers to come in and take a portion of that risk off of their books and in effect act as an insurance company for the insurance company. We have the ability to do that as well. And that is also was a pillar of the traditional version one, V1 Black-owned insurance company, because there were many of them that took advantage of supplier diversity efforts that would allow big companies like a Target or a Walmart, or big insurers like a Prudential or Nationwide, to hire diverse suppliers to help them manage their assets. We are currently the only minority-owned reinsurance company in the country. So if there is a carrier that wants to diversify their supplier ranks, or a large corporate entity that wants to hire a reinsurer, we're unfortunately, and it is tragic, we're the only, and forgive the colloquialism, but we're the only tequila on the shelf.
Mr. Sim, before we run out of time, when did you realize that this was your niche?
This was about 2-3 years ago, we realized that this was a tremendous opportunity, and that, you know, the characteristic, the personal characteristics of the founders of what is now Mammoth Life and Reinsurance put us in a unique position to be one of the few people in the country that could actually lift a recreate a Black-owned insurance company that was aimed at serving the underserved with a mission aimed at making, you know, a decent amount of capital accessible to communities of color. So that was an easy one for us, because we, as we started to do the research around what the competitive environment looked like, it was so wide open. At the time that we started Mammoth, there were two Black-owned life insurance companies in existence. Only two: North Carolina Mutual, which is now in liquidation. Mm-hmm. It does not exist anymore. And Atlanta Life, which was, you know, again, forgive the colloquialism, but it was dead man walking at the time, because of lack of access to capital. I think that's been solved right now, or is in the process of being solved. But again, that is a lift that's, it's taken us 3 years from scratch. I can't imagine how long it's going to take to lift, you know, an Atlanta Life out of whatever condition it was in to be functional again. I can't imagine it.
Brian Sims, founder and president of Mammoth Life and Reinsurance Company. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. This is Stress Analysis. We're listening to a fun assortment of, softer synth pop today, some chill folk tunes. Stay tuned. Before that, WRCT is supported by Sidecar Bakery in North Oakland. Sidecar is an independent coffee shop with a full coffee bar, ready-made breakfast sandwiches, breakfast pastries, savory hand pies, cakes, and pies made in the bakery next door. Sidecar offers a place to eat, study, eat, and hang out with friends in a cafe setting. Open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. For more information, visit their website at sidecar412.com. If you are interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. All right, next up, we're going to hear You're Dead by Norma Tanaga and Morabiasa by Kebby Bloom from Music from Saharan Cell Phones.
To experience is a brand new vibe.
Right about now, NWA quarters in full effect. Judge Dre residing in the case of
something you've never experienced before.
The Isaac Witt takes it and looks for something better, but the smile that she shows makes me a go.
Something strong. And infectious.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of Saturday Night Fever, presented by yours truly, DJ Lee. Of course, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Tonight, we are going to dedicate the time to an amazing Japanese band, Kirinji.
Lady,